all of them. The way this works in practice, but the newspaper exception, it bears mention that the only exception to this section is in relation to newspapers published by members of the Newspaper Association of South Africa. Now, the need for newspapers to be exempted from the section is obvious. Newspapers come out on a daily basis, they could never be submitted for publication or for classification before being published on a, in fact, they come out on a more than daily basis. Like the audit. So the newspaper exception is obvious and necessary. But the difficulty is that it's limited to newspapers published by a member of the Newspaper Association of South Africa. Now, I have no particular instructions when I prepare this opinion as to which newspapers are members of that association, whether they are required to be members of that association, etc. So I can't comment on that, but I have had the benefit of reading the SANAC, South African National Editors Forum, submission to this committee, which I understand have already been made to them. And they make the point that while they also welcome, obviously, the Senate, the NASA, the Newspaper Association exception, they make the point that there are many publications which are not covered by that association that would be hit for the free classification requirement. They refer to community newspapers, to things like Grocott and Mail, and other publications. And they also refer to foreign newspapers that come in, like the New York Times, other newspapers which would be on the They would all be hit for this provision because they're not members, the publishers are not members of the newspaper association. The only point I make is that this sort of exception for publication by a member of the newspaper association cannot be arbitrary. If it is, it could be hit by the legal principle that I refer to on the next page, where the Constitutional Court in the New National Party case says that there must be a rational connection between whatever is prescribed and the aim. So, summing up that principle, legislation and its provisions must be rationally connected to the legitimate government purpose and must not be arbitrary. And accordingly, I advise that committee applies minds to the legitimate reasons for the exclusion referring only to the Newspaper Association of South Africa and not to any newspaper with some other formulation which would not make the exclusion arbitrary or the exception very arbitrary. The next point that I come to is a substantive issue which is also picked up in both the other submissions by the Senate and the National Association of Broadcasters is the prior restraint doctrinal principle. The doctrine of prior restraint basically says that it comes from the United States, and what it means is that primarily in the United States, but in other countries as well, there is a heavy, heavy reluctance to allow prior restraint. So the freedom of expression right is regarded as being so important that one should be allowed to publish what one likes, and you then, if it's crossing legal boundaries, it's meant for penalties after legal. But you can't have a system where, before publication, you have government regulation of what can be published. You're talking in a context. There's a very heavy in the United States, as I said in the next paragraph. In paragraph 33.2, I say that that approach, the American approach, has been endorsed in a number of cases in this country, albeit in provincial divisions, by the first Mandela, the Falaki case, which I'm sure members of the committee are aware of, other judges. However, in the next case I refer to, the media television case, which I was involved in, unfortunately on the losing side, ultimately, the Supreme Court of Appeal pronounced that guidance is not to be had from the American cases, but from our own principles. That's because the American Constitution and ours is so different. It refers to English authority, where in the Attorney General of the British Broadcasting Corporation, Lord Collins said that the prior restraint of publication, though occasionally necessary in serious cases, is a drastic interference with freedom of speech and should only be ordered when there is a substantial risk of grave injustice. Now, our Supreme Court of Appeal has endorsed that approach, and it goes on to say in the judgment that, rather, I summarize what it says. The publication will be unlawful and unacceptable to be prohibited only if the prejudice that the publication might cause to the administration of justice is demonstrable and substantial, and there's a real risk of prejudice will occur if publication takes place. The reference to the administration of justice is because that case concerns publication of a documentary about a very high-profile murder, where the murder trial in Las Vegas. And the Director of Public Prosecution was concerned that their witnesses would be prejudiced, or their case would be prejudiced by the documentary. The court emphasizes mere conjectural speculation that prejudice might occur, not enough. And even then, publication will not be unlawful unless the court is satisfied with this, that the disadvantage of containing the free flow of information outweighs its advantage. In making that evaluation, the court notes that it is not only the interest of those who are associated with publication that needs to be brought into account, but more important, the interest of every person in having access to the information. According to the court, if a risk of that kind is clearly established and cannot be prevented from occurring, by other means, a ban on publication that is confined in scope and content and duration, what is necessary to avoid the risk might be considered. The court further noted that although in the next paragraph, although those forfeiture principles were applicable whenever a court was asked to restrict the exercise of press freedom for the protection of the administration of justice, whether by ban or the publication, whether by ban on the publication or otherwise, they apply with appropriate adaption whenever the exercise of press freedom is sought to be restricted in protection of another right. Here, obviously, the right of the enunciated or the rights of the bill seeks to further. For present purposes, are largely rights of children not to be exposed to material that would be prejudicial to them. However, the court cautioned that where there's a risk to rights that are not capable of substance education, a narrow ban might be all that is required in any manner of course of law. In other words, according to the Supreme Court of Appeal, it should not be assumed that once an infringement of rights is threatened, a ban should immediately ensue, reasonable ban that goes beyond the minimum that is required to protect the threatened rights. In this case, although the court is talking about ban, the same principle would apply to the regulation of speech before publication. This case is regarded now as the leading case on pre-publication regulation. And in fact, what we saw in this case was access to the documentary in order to see whether or not it prejudiced the criminal case. And that was not allowed. The Constitutional Court said that we base our fears on conjectural speculation. In the case of the quote thereafter, that very principle is reinforced that a person or an entity does not per se have a right to obtain a prior publication copy of the material that is to be published about him. In essence, the African companies want a pre-publication copy of the article and to sanction whether the article should be public. Should be published and seeks to assume the role of the censor. Censorship is subversive of the very ethos of the Constitution of the freedom of expression and the public's right to receive information. What is required of the press in an open society such as ours is not to assume, but at all times to be vigilant commentators, reporters, and publishers. In doing so, they must act reasonably, fairly, and responsibly disseminating information. Now, so in the light of those principles, are significant innovations in respect of the constitutionality of Section 16.2. Proceeding from the premise of the effect of the section is that it does constitute a priority threat, which I believe is unarguable. It does do so. The ambit of the section is in our view such that it impermissibly intrudes upon and restricts constitution protected speech. In any event, it fails to provide clear and certain indications as to what speech is permissible and what's not. The principal difficulty with the section is the fact that it refers to visual presentations, descriptions, or representations, and then I quote these words which I referred to earlier, of or amounting to the various types of speech, the four categories that we refer to. Ideally, here under the manner in which the itemized categories of speech are dealt with, but the present purpose was to focus on the words of or amounting to. As pointed out in the Spanish submission, this is particular paragraph 3.3 thereof. The type of speech that will attract mandatory classification in terms of Section 16.2 is not limited to that amounts to speech prescribed under Section 16.2 of the Constitution. It's a bit confusing here because the sections are the same, Section 16.2 of the Constitution and 16.2 of the Act. same numbering, but we're just saying that we're talking about the section, the unconstitutionality of the section we have. It's not limited. So the type that will attract mandatory classification in 762 of the Act is not limited to the type of speech that in two paragraphs of the Constitution paragraphs. Instead, and because of the use of the word art, any form of visual description, depiction, or presentation of such proscribed speech, regardless of purpose and context, triggers the mandatory classification requirements of 16.2. I just want to pause there for a moment. It is so that there is an artistic and literary exception which is dealt with in the later section that deals with classification categories. That doesn't assist here with the topic we're dealing with, because what we're dealing with is the requirement that before they can publish at all, they must submit the publication for classification if it contains this sort of speech. And it's that prior submission for approval, or not approval, but for classification, that is the problem, not the classification itself, which may be classification that limits publication, such a submission one. In fact, that point is in the next paragraph, but I did say that I'm in paragraph 37. I'm uncertain as to whether the use of the word of or in section 16.2 is deliberate, or as a result of an oversight. If deliberate, there would appear to me to be no justifiable reason why speech that is clearly constitutionally protected should be subjected to what amounts to a permanent system of prior restraint operated by the state. I would point out in this regard that the fact is, and this is the point I just made, the fact that publication once submitted can escape a more onerous classification if in the assessment of the classification committee that has scientific, literary, artistic merit does not remedy the fact that publication is subject to a prior restraint. If I ever the utilization of the words of all, and the consequences thereof outside of doubt and in the Senate submissions are unintentional, then it would seem to me that the simple deletion of these words would contribute significantly to the amended act passing constitutional amendment. The fact that the use of the phrase of or amounting to may not have actually received, as I said, with all these efforts, as being someone who's used to criticizing legislation but not used to drafting it. In order to have received the thought and consideration that it should, is also indicated that the fact that the utilization of that phrase in relation to sexual conduct is inadequate and effectively without meaning. Thus, the mere visual presentation, description, or representation of sexual activity can in itself amount to sexual conduct. That is, of course, not the case with other types of speech outlines, where, of course, speech itself can be the invoking of hatred or the incitement to violence, etc. Speech can't be sexual conduct. Certainly not as defined. That is, of course, not the case with other types of speech outlines, which suggests to me that the drafters of the section may not have been alarmed for the full consequences of the utilization of these words in the section. There are further difficulties with 16.2, the following definition. First, it applies to any person subject only to the newspaper publishing exception. That's a very wide net that is cast. Any person who has virtually anything to do, not only with the publication, but the distribution, advertising, etc., with his publication. Second, this is also dealt with in the Senate submission. The section refers not only to the publication as the previous section, 16.1, but to the creation, production, publication, or advertisement of any publication. The definition of publication in the Act remains unaltered, and I've given the definition there, it's clearly very extensive. And the point simply being made is that the net of persons, the pool of persons who are defined themselves affected by is, as is said in the Senate submission, persons throughout the supply chain in relation to publication. Third, in 40.3, I say that the phrase visual presentation is clearly defined very broadly, as I said earlier. Fourth, one should have regard to the categories in subsection 16.2a to d. I say, notwithstanding the breadth of the fourth set of aspects of section 16.2, and subject to what I've said above about the of or amounting to, I do not consider references to propaganda for war and incitement of imminent violence to raise issues of constitutionality. The reason for this is that type of speech is, of course, expressly prescribed by section 16.2 of the Constitution. In other words, you do not have a right of freedom of expression in relation to that type of speech. Already referred to that. For that reason, I don't think that raises a constitutional issue. 45, I say that I do love the express regulation in respect to competition. Obviously, competition is too antique. In my view, although it could be argued the other way as to the other two submissions, subsection D is likely to pass the limitations inquiry, although the same cannot be said for subsection A. The following being mentioned in this regard. Special conduct, which is what subsection 2A deals with, is not excluded from the ambit of freedom of expression under the Constitution. In other words, one is allowed to have freedom of expression in relation to special conduct. This notwithstanding, sexual conduct is defined very broadly in value. It is said to include male genitals in the state of arousal or stimulation, the only display of genitals or the anal region, masturbation, bestiality, sexual intercourse with the real or stimulated, including anal sexual intercourse, sexual contact, indirect fondling and touching the intimate parts of the body, including the breast, without any object, penetration of the vagina, etc. And just to give you an they do it in the context of films, not publications. The point is that, for better or for worse, certainly something, clearly things like male genitals instead of arousal or stimulation, one wouldn't expect to see in mainstream publications. But sexual intercourse is either described or shown in many movies, mainstream movies. That's the point that the national broadcasters making their submission. And things like the fondling of breasts, the touching of parts of the body, one comes across on a regular basis. Any depiction of that or description of that would be itself a publication. I go on after dealing with the definitions. Now, the basis of this definition, sexual conduct is rendered susceptible to classification under section 16.2 of the law. In my view, irrespective of what the outcome of the classification process would be, the fact that such expression is rendered susceptible the pre-classification on the basis of the definition is broader than presently provided for is problematic. Given that it constitutes an obvious limitation of the right to freedom of expression in section 16.1 of the Constitution, it must satisfy the limitations of inquiry under section 36 of the Constitution if it is to survive an attack. In terms of section 36, the rights of the Bill of Rights may be limited only in terms of law general application to the extent of the limitation is reasonable and justifiable in an open and democratic society based on human dignity, equality, and freedom, taking into account all relevant factors, including the nature of the right, the importance of the purpose of the limitation, the nature and extent of the limitation, the relation between the limitation and its purpose, and very importantly, less restrictive means to achieve the purpose. In my view, the statute found it difficult to meet the limitation inquiry under section 36 of the Constitution, in that it is unclear to what purpose is to serve by including sexual conduct within the ambit of section 16.2 of the Act. The mere existence of sexual conduct has no relevance to a classification under section 16.4. As we'll address at a later stage, section 16.4 does not even allow for a classification on the basis of sexual conduct. To this extent, the criterion of sexual conduct under section 16.2a seems to bear no rational connection to the classification under section 16.4. Just that to give you an indication of what that is about. Section 16.4 allows for classification of explicit sexual conduct. Classification based on explicit sexual conduct as content. It doesn't allow for classification based merely upon the content that allows sexual conduct. The next point I make is that it's unclear as to what the purpose of the limitation is, or more particularly what harm, if any, is sought to address those provisions. And in any event, there are seemingly less restrictive means by which to satisfy the objective, such as guidelines in relation to acceptable publication. In the circumstances, I'm of the view that section 16.2a is unduly broad and is unlikely to pass constitutional muster. Apologize if there's some graphical errors. The second use of the word pass should be deleted from the second last word in that sentence. The paragraph should be deleted. Section 16, the next point, section 16.2d refers to advocacy of hatred based on any identifiable group characteristic and that constitutes incitement to cause harm. That is broader than section 16.2c of the Constitution. 16.2c applies in respect of advocacy of hatred that is based on three categories, that is race, ethnicity, gender, or religion. An identifiable group characteristic as referred to in subsection 2d is defined as a characteristic that identifies has a much broader idea. Individual as a member of the group identifies race, gender, sex, pregnancy, marital status, ethnic or social origin, colour, sexual orientation, age, disability, religion, conscience, belief, culture, language, birth, nationality. In the Islamic Unity Code, the Constitutional Court noted that three categories of expression are enumerated in Section 16, which are expressed in specifically defined terms. According to the Court, 16.2a and b are respectively considered as propaganda for war and incitement of human violence. 16.2c was said to be directed at what is commonly referred to as hate speech. The Court acknowledged that what is not protected by the Constitution is expression of speech that amounts to advocacy of hatred based on one of the listed grounds the Court has determined, and in addition which amounts to incitement to cause harm. There is no doubt the state has a particular interest in regulating this type of expression because of the harm it may pose to the constitutional mandated objective of holding non-racial and non-sexual society in favor of human dignity and achievement of equality. The Court noted that there is accordingly no bar to the enactment of legislation that prohibits such expression. Any regulation of expression that falls within the categories enumerated in 16.2 would not be a limitation of the right in 16.1. In respect of any extension beyond what is already prescribed in 16.2, the Court said the following: where the state extends the scope of regulation beyond the expression envisaged in Section 16.2, it encroaches on the realm of protected expression and can do so only if such regulation meets the justification criteria in Section 36.1 of the Constitution. The Court specifically states that whilst on the one hand the categories of speech referred to 16.2c of the Constitution are carefully circumscribed, no such tailoring is evident in the relevant portion of Clause 2a. Clause 2a is a reference to the Broadcasting Code of Conduct that was an issue in the Islamic Unity Convention case. There is no doubt that each, the Court went on, there is no doubt that each of the forms of expression listed in 16.2 could produce the result envisaged in Clause 2a of the guidelines. Expression that makes propaganda for war, 16.2a, may, depending on the circumstances, threaten relations between sections of the population, or produce a situation where these are likely to be prejudiced. The converse is not true, however. Not every expression or speech that is likely to prejudice relations between sections of the population would be propaganda for war, or incitement of imminent violence, or advocacy of hatred that is not only based on race, like race, ethnicity, gender, or religion, but that also constitutes incitement to cause harm. There may well be instances where the prohibition of Clause 2a coincides with what is excluded from the protection of the right. The real question, though, is whether a clause in prohibiting that which is not excluded from the protection of 16.1 does so in a manner which is constitutionally impermissible. I go on to say that it bears mention that each of the aforestated grounds included within the Act's definition of its identifiable group characteristic, save for that of nationality, each of these grounds is presently recognized as prohibited grounds of discrimination under Section 9 of the Constitution. In addition, the Promotion of Equality and Prevention of Unfair Discrimination Act, which I refer to as the Equality Act, prohibits hate speech in Section 10. In terms thereof, and subject to proviso in Section 12 of the Act, no person may publish, propagate, advocate, or communicate words based on one or more prohibited grounds against any person that could reasonably be construed to demonstrate clear intention be hurtful, be harmful, to incite harm, to promote or propagate hatred. Notably, the definition of prohibited grounds in Section 1 of the Equality Act refers to race, gender, sex, pregnancy, marital status, ethnic or social origin, color, sexual orientation, age, disability, religion, conscience, belief, culture, language, and death. Or being any other ground where discrimination based on that ground either causes or perpetuates a feeling of disadvantage, undermines human dignity, or adversely affects the equal enjoyment of persons' rights and freedom in a serious manner that is comparable to the definition of crime and aim. I've gone into that in some detail because, of course, that act deals in terms with proscribed speech, which is tailored to meet the requirements of the Constitution, the regulations thereof, that type of speech. Section 12 of the Equality Act prohibits the dissemination and publication of information that is considered discriminatory. In terms thereof, no person may disseminate or broadcast any information, publish or display any evidence or notice that could reasonably be construed or reasonably be understood to demonstrate a clear intention to unfairly discriminate against any person. I emphasize that formulation because it's very different to what's found in the present as well. The fiction is as a subject of arises as a bona fide engagement in artistic creativity, academic and scientific inquiry, fair and accurate reporting of the public interest, or publication of any information that is of notice in accordance with Section 16 of the Constitution, is not precluded by the fiction. Insofar as the addition of nationality to the list of grounds in Section 9.3 of the Constitution goes, I'm of the view that the sufficient constitutional courts and other authorities support the contention that it is a ground worthy of protection. I refer to the authority in the next paragraph. In our view, that it opens the legislature to limit the ambit of Section 16.1 of the Constitution by expanding the grounds referred to in 16.2c so as to accord with 9.3 of the Constitution, provided that it is capable of showing basis to it. There are several factors which, in our view, would favour the constitutionality of this provision. In summary, the following would prove relevant, in our view, to the taxation inquiry. The grounds, as included in the definition of identifiable group characteristics, represent a closed list, and save for that of nationality, are already consistent with the grounds listed in Section 9.3 of the Constitution. Secondly, the Equality Act already prohibits hate speech on the basis of grounds recognised by the Equality Act, which are even broader than the expanded grounds included in the proposed definition of identifiable group characteristics. The Equality Act already prohibits the dissemination, broadcast, display, and publication. Information that could reasonably be construed or reasonably be understood to demonstrate clear intentions to unfairly discriminate. The ambit of the proposed section 16.2d is circumscribed by the fact that it requires the advocacy of hatred and that constitutes insight to the cause of harm. D, the objective sought to be achieved by the inclusion of this criterion is a constitutionally sound one. And lastly, the limitation of the state of process relates only to the submission to pre-classification, and to that end will not necessarily result in refusal of submission to publish. To this extent, the provision is narrower than its ambit is known under the Constitution. The last point to note about 16.2 is that the publication must be submitted to the prescribed manner for examination and classification to the board before it is exhibited, distributed, offered, etc. I think given the composition of the board is problematic. Personally, I should have expanded on this, but it has been fully answered in the National Board of Commission, the difficulties of composition of the board, as opposed, for instance, to the target, which we treat as broadcasting. And those points are, I thought, in the National Board of Commission. The next point, the next subheading is the referral to the Classification Committee. The Classification Committee is tasked with examining the classification and then classifying it in the prescribed manner. I make the following comments in respect of the section. In my view, once again, subject to what I said above is an extension of the prescription to include representations of, as opposed to that which merely amounts to, the type of speech targeted at the publication, falling within the refused classification in Section 16.4a. In the category dealt with in Section 16.4a, are in my view justifiable, notwithstanding the fact that there is no limit to discretion given to the Classification Committee, and that provided the requirements of the section are met, the classification is for entry. The result, of course, is that it may not be distributed at all. Dealing first with child pornography, and these are the subcategories that are defined in 16.4. There are four of them. Classification. The first is child pornography. I refer to the Urea case, where the court says that the purpose of the Act was to curb child pornography, which is seen as an evil in all democratic societies. I don't need to explain this committee why child pornography is evil. It not only encourages citizens to use child pornography, but it has an effect clearly on the children involved. Um, case and before the judge an armed review of child pornography can legitimately be characterized as an accused classification which having been counted publication. Improper gathering for war and incitement of human violence, insofar as expression amounting to either, again, the same point I made earlier, that type of speech has already increased the first draft of the Constitution, and I don't see an issue. I can't see an issue arising there. Then the advocacy of hatred, based on an identifiable group characteristic, the reasons already given, I'm the view that that could probably be adopted under the refused classification category. 41.2, I say, has certain reservations in respect of some of the publications given under the next classification. The answer to the problem they mentioned, clarity and certainty, particularly in light of the consequences of this classification, are particularly important. And B, the object is thought to be achieved in respect of each subsection is a particular relevance, and after seeing to deal with each subsection in turn. That is also in section 15.4b. First, the sexual conduct is rather to show with respect to the right to human dignity of any person. It bears mention in this regard that explicit sexual conduct is defined in far narrower terms in the Amendment Bill than the definition of sexual conduct in the Act. Explicit sexual conduct is defined for the purposes of this section as graphic and detailed visual presentation or description of any conduct characteristically associated with sexual intercourse. I thought to reiterate that notwithstanding the fact that section 16.2 applies to sexual conduct, this classification applies only to explicit sexual conduct. Whilst there may be some element of uncertainty as to exactly what constitutes the violation of or shows disrespect for the right to human dignity, I am satisfied that the object is thought to be achieved by the section is constitutional compliance. I can just perhaps alert the committee members here to the fact that I copied and I have further thoughts about this after preparing this opinion. And contrary to what I say, in the very last, in paragraph 59 of this opinion, where I say that having considered the submissions of the broadcasters and the editors, I agree there with, and the differences are only minor. On this point, I've had a rethink, and in fact, I've appreciated that the editors' forum submissions come to a different conclusion in regard to this question. They say this is too vague. They say you can't, with any certainty, say what is likely to be what is likely to violate and show disrespect for the right to human dignity of any person. I disagree with that. I'm satisfied that the object is thought to be achieved with the section is constitutionally compliant. Constitutional and court jurisprudence in particular has repeatedly recognized the dignity of all people. Constitutional Court has said it follows the value of dignity in our constitutional framework cannot therefore be doubted. The Constitution asserts dignity to contradict our past, in which human dignity is much of Africans is routinely and cruelly denied. It asserts its truth to inform the future, to invest in our democracy, respect the intrinsic worth of all human beings. Human dignity therefore informs constitutional adjudication and interpretation at a range of levels. It is a value that informs the interpretation of any, possibly all other rights. This Court has already acknowledged the importance of the constitutional value of dignity in certain rights such as the right to equality, the right not to be punished in a cruel, inhuman, or degrading way, the right to life. Human dignity is also a constitutional value that is of central significance in the limitation of the balances. Section 10 over makes clear that dignity is not only a value fundamental to our constitution, and this is an important thing. It is a justiciable and enforceable right that must be protected, must be respected and protected. I'm according to the view that classification that targets explicit sexual conduct as defined as that which violates or shows disrespect to human dignity will cause constitutional justice. I disagree with the editors in that regard. The reason essentially is that, as the court here says, in the text, it's not only a value, it's actually a right that is justiciable. The fact that you, if you are hit by the section, that difficulty or people may disagree as to what the front of the dignity doesn't mean that you can't have a court decide that. And as with many things, the way a court can interpret the information is uncertain until the court does it. And you can't use that as a reason to say it's unconstitutional. The next aspect is the other incest, rape, or conduct, or an act which is degrading of human beings. There's not supposed to be a problem in respect of bestiality, incest, or rape. Bestiality and incest are specific offences and sexual offences at all. In relation to that, in the Chapman case, the Supreme Court appeal held official rights in general and rape in particular, the humiliating, degrading, and brutal invasion of the privacy, the dignity, and the person of the victim, and that women were entitled to the protection of these rights, which were basic to the ethos of the Constitution and to independence for civilization. Of course, the knowledge that we are determined to protect the equality, dignity, and freedom of all women, and we shall show no mercy to those who seek to invade those rights. With that, as a backdrop, I think the prescription and the classification for depiction of rape is likely to pass constitutional muster. I have certain reservations in respect to conduct or an act which is degrading of human beings. But that is a different wording to the affront of the dignity of the human being. That might be in a different meaning. In my view, the Sukhan is extremely broad and very vague. This notwithstanding, in the opinion of the committee, the requirement is met to carry an excess of classification. Unless it be said under the scientific literary or system merit exception. In my view, this requirement is likely to be found to be unconstitutional in a sense against Section 36 because of its vagueness and overbreadth. And I say that because, as I understand, it would have to be a different test and a different requirement than dignity. And it would be something less than the front of dignity in those who need it. So vague as to be incapable of self-regulation, and would regulate your conduct accordingly, and it will also lead open to a very arbitrary classification to be resolved by a classification committee. Conduct of an act which constitutes itself and often encourages the most harmful behavior, once again, it's intended to be made, the wedding prophet can make this clear. It's so unclear as to what conduct would constitute incitement or promote harmful behavior. The problem is with harmful behavior. They are incapable, in my view, of precise definition, and you wouldn't be able to implement this provision. The court wouldn't allow it. Explicit infliction of sexual and domestic violence. The Constitutional Court's recognition of this regard is sexual violence and the threat of sexual violence. There's the core of women's subordination in society they have mentioned. According to the court, it is the single greatest threat to self-determination of the women. More recently, the Constitutional Court has reiterated the prevalence of sexual violence in our society is deeply troubling. With due regard to these comments, I do not foresee any obvious difficulties with these requirements. Indeed, in this regard, I should mention, without wanting to preface how any defense to the constitutional challenge would be met, I'm suggesting that any constitutional challenge would have to be met with a twofold response. One, that there's a correlation between exposure to sexual domestic violence and an individual expressing such violent tendencies, and two, that mere exposure to such violence constitutes, or depiction of such violence, constitutes an affront to the dignity and personhood of members of the group subjected to such violence. As I raise a little caution with respect to the following, neither the act nor the law defines domestic violence as sexual violence. In giving effect to this ground, one thus relies on the definition of domestic violence as the Domestic Violence Act. Terms thereof, domestic violence means physical abuse, sexual abuse, emotional, verbal, and psychological abuse, economic abuse, discrimination, harassment, stalking, damage to property, entering into the concerned person without consent, the parties do not share the same reason. Or any other controlling or abusive behavior would complain that such conduct harms or may cause imminent harm to the safety and health and well-being of the complainant. I express some concern that this definition is potentially overbroad for the purposes of an XX classification, and on account thereof, the relevant provision in the bill is potentially vulnerable to failing under Section 36 inquiry. I further draw attention to the fact that criminal law, sexual offences, and related matters amendments are sought. Sexual offences will define the concept of sexual violation in Section 1 thereof. In the interest of clarity and certainty, the amendment bill may seek to cross-refer there to specify the aspects thereof that apply to this law, the law of coherence, regulation, and lawmaking. Explicit visual presentation of sexual violence, in my view, the state has legitimate interest in the strict regulation of this type of expression, particularly given the high levels of violence in society. Accordingly, I'm of view the inclusion of this type of expression under an XX classification of the constitutional sound. I note the exception with respect to the vague three-day documentary or publication of scientific literary or artistic merit, in which event the publication is to be classified with reference to the guidelines relating to the protection of children from exposure to the excluding altered or aging appropriate materials, the child pornography is not that subject to the child. I also note the absence of any reference to public interest in the second discussion, which is part of the refused classification of the court. I must apologize for what follows in this paragraph, and I would ask you to delete from this opinion the words beginning particularly and ending material, so that was left over from the previous draft that I should have come up. I apologize for that. The last one was kind of, it doesn't make sense. It's complicated. 41.3, I'm still unsatisfied with the criteria for classification. Madam Chair, the law sentence in the present paragraph F, subparagraph F on page 41, goes over on page 42. The third version of 42, the fourth page, it talks about everything after that word, up to highly material. With regard to the classification for XAT, i.e. the concern in visual presentations and descriptions of presentations of explicit sexual conduct, I'm satisfied with the exception in the United States Constitutional Notice. 16.4D deals with publications that concern visual presentations and descriptions of presentations which may be disturbing or harmful to an Asian attractive to children, and requires that the classification reflect that. Reflect the age limit for children. That, in my view, is also constitutionally compliant. I've considered provisions of section 16(5), which requires the chief executive officer of the board to publish by notice in the Gazette any details of any refused classification, double X or X18 publication. I'm satisfied that it is constitutionally sound. The object is seemingly to engender a concept of accountability and transparency, both of which have been recognized by the Constitution according to the laudable objective. That is, authority I refer to next. And then section 16(6), which requires the board, the chief executive officer of the board, to refer to the lead for investigation and prosecution any publication which is submitted to it which contains child pornography. That is, in my view, constitutionally sound. I then go on to clause 21 of the law, which deals with classification of fraud in the game. Section 18 of the Act, I first provide what is text. Okay. Then in paragraph 6, after the fiction amendment bill is now entitled classification of forms in the game, the outset of the definition, the definition of form has been amended to be as follows. Any sequence of visual images recorded in such a manner that by using such recording, such images will be capable of being seen as a moving picture. The soundtrack associated with any exhibited illustration relating to film is defined as a particular paragraph, and includes any picture intended for exhibition through any medium or device. The amendment bill also defines the game as a computer game, video game, or interactive computer software for interactive game playing, where the results achieved at various stages of the game are determined in response to decisions, inputs, and direct involvement of the game player or player. The deal for the aforementioned definition of Clause 21 of the bill refers to the following key aspects. Any person who distributes broadcasts or exhibits any form of game must, in a prescribed manner, register with the board as a distributor, exhibitor, or form of game, and submit for examination and classification any form of game that has been classified. The board then refers any publications submitted to the classification committee. The classification committee then examines the form and classifies it. In paragraph 49, I say it is notable that pursuant to clause 27, which amends section 23(3), a broadcaster who is subject to regulation by the Independent Communications Authority of South Africa or SASA shall, for the purpose of broadcasting, be exempt from the duty to apply the classification of the formal game, and subject to section 24(8)(2) and 3, shall, in relation to that threat, subject to those sections, are important, and are dealt with extensively in the National Broadcasters Association. Just like you said, I will refer to that. Shall, in relation to the formal game, not be subject to any classification or condition made by the board in relation to that formal game. our view, the fourth exemption is consistent with the Faith Christian Constitution. The effect of the third section 23.3, if enacted, would be that Muslims broadcasters will not, in general, be required to submit forms for classification. Is the board in advance of screening them? I do not at this stage address the exceptions to this proposition. They are fully dealt with the national broadcasters. Section 192 of the Constitution requires the national legislation must establish an independent authority to regulate broadcasting in the public interest and to ensure fairness and diversity of views broadly represented by the society. The Council is body established by Parliament to regulate broadcasting according to Section 192 of the Constitution. It is apparent from the provisions of Section 53-61 of the Electronic Communications Act that the Council does regulate broadcasting content. To this extent, it is submitted in order to the Constitution to compile an exemption from the board classifying broadcasting material, forms, etc., but be contained in the board to make the Constitution compliant. In respect to the remaining aspects of Clause 21, I refer to what I've already said in relation to Clause 19, and I'll use of those comments of equal relevance to Clause 21. With regard to Clause 22, it's a minor point, but the point is also made by one of the other submissions. Clause 22 introduces the Section 18 capital A, which says where full journal publication has been classified or exempted from classification, and that is important, those are important words, or exempted from classification in terms of acting must. It deals with what must be displayed on the box or on the publication. And the problem with that wording is that what must be displayed is the classification that has been afforded to the publication. In other words, it makes no provision for exemption. And it's a simple thing to be notified. That can be simply remedied by reformulating what follows, taking capital A1, as to what the content of the wording that appears on the form or before the form or on the box should contain. But unless that is done, I expect reservations as to the workability and implementation of the provision is going to give Clause 29 of the law introduces the section 24A, as it says, B and C. The proposed section 24A is titled Prohibition of Offences and Penalties on Distribution and Exhibition of Forms Deemed in Publication. The section makes various forms of conduct an offence. One of the issues that I expect concern on is the criteria by which this is done. As is apparent from, for instance, section 24A2C, one of the criteria is if the film, game, or publication would have been classified in a particular way. The difficulty with this provision is that an individual expects an ex post facto to determine a classification that would have been made by a classification committee as the publication or film being submitted to it. This is particularly problematic in light of the broad criteria that I've already referred to. The second issue that I'm concerned with is the content of section 24A4. In terms thereof, any person who knowingly distributes or exhibits any form, game, or publication classified X18, or which contains depictions, and this is a problematic word, or which contains depictions or descriptions of scenes of sexual conduct to a person under the age of 18, shall be guilty of an offence and liable upon conviction to a fine or to imprisonment for a period not exceeding 5 years, or to both fine and such imprisonment. Significantly, this section applies to depictions or descriptions of scenes of sexual conduct, notwithstanding the fact that an X18 rating under the proposed section 1614 applies only to presentations and representations of explicit sexual conduct. Accordingly, the net effect of the proposed section 24A4 is that it creates an offence in respect to depictions and scenes which would not fall within an X18 classification under the proposed section 1614. For this reason, in my view, the proposed section 24A4 is vulnerable to structure. I have a similar problem with section 24B3. The proposed section provides as follows. Any person who has control of any form, game, or publication which concerns depiction of scenes of sexual conduct and fails to take all reasonable steps to prevent access to such materials by any person under the age of 18 shall be guilty of an offence. Address the breadth of the definition of sexual conduct in addition to that as mentioned, but in terms of the same point of this matter, the same reason I believe the section is
I may just add that the problems with Section 24AMD are elaborated upon in much more detail, and I've endorsed those in my opinion, in the National Association of Law Council Commission and SUDA Committee. They make the point that while the exemption given, not the exemption, but the the exemption for broadcasters who are regulated by CASA to have films and material that they're going to broadcast managed under the classification is really obligatory for the fact that they are struck by the criminal sanction penalties under Section 24A, B and 24A and 24B. The reason for that is that it is an offense to distribute film and other material which has, as a matter of fact, been censored. And in fact, at present, which contains scenes of sexual conduct. And as I said, that's really in fact a part to the people of the majority, a very large number of movies regularly shown on our mainstream television channels. So the difficulty that they identify there is one that I endorse, and it appears to be a lack of synchronicity between what is exempted for broadcasters and what is created. Those are in essence my views on the law. There are obviously certain things that can be said, which have been said in the other two submissions, but in essence, for those reasons, they are difficult to make decisions about any questions that you do wish. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Advocate. Dami, you have counsel. Honorable members, do we need to ask this vehicle before or not question that? Okay, let's take a break of 5 minutes and we take any time I think there was a tea or water and somebody probably asked me. I have to apologize. Thank you.
Yeah, it might have to be the marathon maybe by the end of one. Why was that?
What do you
want
to do?
No,
and you know,
I don't.